Hi, everyone. It's Tom Power. I'm back with a brand new and very special episode of Toy Heart, my podcast about bluegrass. It is an exclusive conversation with none other than Billy Strings that we recorded at last year's International Bluegrass Music Association Conference. If you love bluegrass as much as we do, and I assume you do, then this episode is certainly for you. Download and listen to this and all episodes of Toy Heart on the BGS Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I always have a lot of doubt right before I'm starting a new project. I think the reason why it feels like success makes it almost worse is that we all think, once I am successful or once I reach this certain spot, I won't feel this way. And then you do and you still do, so it feels worse.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. This week is our sixth and final episode of our reissue series, where we dig back through our archive of 3 years of conversations to find some of our favorites and share them with you anew. But these are only a handful of our many conversations. So if you're on a long drive or mowing your lawn this summer, please take a second to dig through our previous conversations and see what else can inspire you. And if you'd like, head to our YouTube channel where you can find playlists curated by topic.
And today's reissue features Brandi Clark, originally from November 13th, 2024. Brandi Clark is a Grammy-winning artist and songwriter who has had her songs recorded by Sheryl Crow, Miranda Lambert, Kacey Musgraves, Billy Currington, Darius Rucker, and many more. She also co-wrote the music for Tony-winning Broadway show Shucked with Shane McAnally. And we got to really dig deep with Brandi and talk about self-doubt, finding community, and standing out rather than trying to fit in. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Brandi Clark. Thank you for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I have always been so interested to talk to you because I feel like, especially when 12 Stories came out, so much of the narrative was about how you were a writer first, like from press, of consuming the narrative that press put forward, and that you couldn't get a record deal around Nashville.
So you
figured it out on your own or got an investor or just did it yourself. And also I remember age being such a part of the story of like, she's not 20 years old. So all things that I'm personally very interested in and like bucking norms of like not going through the system. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like in the reality of for you in that journey of staying the course and finding other ways to keep going?
I was thinking yesterday, probably my best and worst quality is I just will not give up. I can really count on maybe one or two fingers the things in my life I've quit. I just have a real hard time giving up. And sometimes I think that's a really good thing. And then sometimes I think it's not a good thing because I know a lot of people I work with that can quit things real easy that are real successful because when something doesn't work, they're like, okay, let's cut bait and move on to the next thing. That's not a gift I have. But it is why I think my 12 Stories record came out because at the time I made 12 Stories, I think I was 35. And I, at that point, was really... I thought I had completely let go of making my own records. I was at a publishing company that gave us some money if they thought we had any potential as an artist. They gave me some of that money and I made an EP. I do remember that. So I clearly had some want of being an artist left in me. I just didn't realize how deep it was. And then I was writing songs, singing my own demos for the most part. And Emily Marchbanks, who at the time worked at Fitzgerald Hartley, heard some of my stuff through Cindy Foreman, who was this publisher who I didn't work with, but I've always loved. I work with Cindy now, but I didn't then. And Emily approached me about making a record. And at first I thought she wasn't serious. Her enthusiasm for my music was so big. I just didn't know anyone could feel that passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
But she did. And so her and another manager there, Terry Elam, actually paid for me to make my first record with Dave Brainerd. Terry covered the initial costs so that we could get in the studio and record those 12 songs. So then, you know, I was all in. I was dreaming it. And then they started to pitch it around town and it just didn't get much traction. I do remember I met with all the labels and there were very few just flat out passes. Like, no, we don't want to do this. Most of them were like, I love it, but I don't know what to do with it. I remember we got really close with Rounder, which is not a Nashville label, or it wasn't then. And the company got bought, if I'm not mistaken, but I went and did my showcase for them right after I had done an interview that ended up leading to me being one of the writers of the musical Chuck. So I always associate that with Rounder. But then what happened was we were just, what are we going to do? And I remember being pretty devastated and thinking, I don't even know if we should put it out, you know? And then I thought, no, you know what? We've worked too hard on it. And I remember I emailed Emily and said, I'll go forward if you will. And that should have just made her day. I think she was in Ireland at the time. And then a guy named Jim Burnett heard my record through a friend of mine, Scott Kernahan. And at the time, Scott was managing, I think, Charlie Worsham. And Scott saw me play at a little Christmas party at Leslie Graham's house, who also became a massive player for me in my career. But Jim Burnett heard my record, and I remember Emily and I met with him at the old Nashville near Music Row, and he said he wanted to do it. And so we were like, sure. And it was like a page and a half contract, an easy, fair contract. And he just said, I don't want to stand in the way. If a better or bigger opportunity comes your way, I'll get out of the way. And he did. Eventually, when Warner LA approached me, Jim made it really easy to do a deal. So then,
that's amazing.
Yeah, he's an angel, honestly. All these people are that I'm talking about. Without any of them, it wouldn't have happened. So basically with Jim, what we had was the money for a publicist. And so he was using Surefire Media at the time. My person there was Jackie Marushka. And she worked really hard, her and Emily both, to get great press on the record because we didn't have the means to go after terrestrial radio. Now, Sirius XM played Strikes. It was a highway find back when John Marks was there. That did a lot for the record, but it was that early press that really drove it. I got things like Letterman and Imus, and it just started to happen. And all the things that had at least felt like they were against me, like the fact that I was not 20, the fact that I was openly gay, the fact that my music was left of where the mainstream was, all of that sort of became for me as the record started to roll out.
That's amazing. And I feel like your story is so cool because of also the narrative around like mainstream country music, of especially the last like 10, 20 years of you have to fit a certain mold. It's so much harder for a woman. It's so much harder if you're just not a straight white guy. So it's amazing just that happened for you and that it was embraced. Well, how has that been like personally, emotionally navigating, operating in that world with all the things that, quote unquote, you said were seemingly against you, but then worked in your favor because you were strong in who you are and being open with who you are?
Something that got said to me actually by my manager, Gail Gelman, I think about it a lot because there was a time where I was really disappointed that I didn't fit in. And I just said, I don't know where I fit in all this. Because I grew up loving country music, wanting to be in country music, wanting my music on country radio, because that's where I discovered so many great artists. And I said, I just don't know where I fit in. And she said, you don't fit in. You stand out. That really changed it for me. It's funny how like one thing can change it. And that did. And I didn't ever want to fit in again after I heard that.
Yeah, I love how that flips the script and it flips the power dynamic from this thing where you're underwater to you are the boat. You know, you are floating. That's really beautiful.
Well, and it takes like your own personal growth and relationship to that because the business side of music continually tells you what you heard from the labels of, well, we don't know what to do with this. I always remind myself and others about this. The greatest artists that so many of us admire are the ones who stand out, who maybe for a long time, the marketing machine or A&R people didn't know what to do with them because they didn't fit easily into a box or a genre. But those are the artists that I love, the ones who try different things and explore and are singular and not just oh, that fits neatly into this box and that marketing plan is really easy to come up with. So I love that was a turning point for you of, okay, I don't need to fit in.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And I really think most of the artists that we all admire and are influenced by, I think most of them probably didn't fit in. They stood out.
When you first moved to Nashville, had you wanted to be an artist originally?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I originally came to Nashville. I was 21. Definitely wanted to be an artist. And I'm glad, you know, because I don't know if I would have moved here. I don't think I knew enough yet about the business of songwriting that would have moved me. It probably would have because I was so into the music business. But I always say when I moved here, I was like 80% artist, 20% songwriter. And then those things switched over time. I feel like now I'm 50-50. I think there's no artistry for me without songwriting. But my own artistry also drives a lot of the songs that I write now. There was a time when what drove me was trying to write songs to get recorded in the market. Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't my own artistry, wasn't driving. Now, I always enjoyed that. And I don't think that's a second place, by the way, either. I have so many friends that's the path they've taken and envious of the songs they write. So I could never say it was a second place. It's just a different race, I guess.
According to the research that we did before our conversation, you were in town for over a decade before you had like kind of any big cuts come through as a writer or anything like that, right? What was that like?
Well, I mean, there were ups and downs in it. When I first moved to town, I definitely thought I was a much better songwriter than I was. And that's also lucky because had I known what an infantile songwriter I was, I might have thought I need to keep working and then I'll move there in a couple of years. And I think the only way to really get better is to be around people who are better and work at that every day. And that's what I did. And along the way, I had a lot of almost, I mean, there's steps in it. You know, like I was in town 5 years before I got a publishing deal, and that felt like this massive thing, and it was a massive thing. And then things have changed so much. But back then, you know, you would do demo sessions. So then the next big thing was to write enough good songs that your publisher would pay for a demo session. And then it was about getting a song on hold, which for anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's where an artist asks you to not play the song for anyone else, that they're going to hold it and decide if they're going to record it. The next step was to get songs recorded. And I did that pretty quickly into having a publishing deal. I was getting songs recorded. They were just getting recorded on artists that got dropped from labels, projects that didn't come out, all those things. You know, for me, a lot lined up all at once. Right around the time that I got approached about making a record, I had my first hits on the radio as a songwriter. It was like all the fireworks were going off at once, but I had been working, lighting all those fuses for a long time.
Yeah, one thing I really enjoyed about our conversation with Lori was keeping your eye out for these little subtle signposts along the way. They might not be big successes or big disappointments or anything, but like the little signpost is, okay, I'm on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you kind of had that experience through this decade before things really started to click?
Yeah, and I was around people. Speaking of Lori, one of my first co-writers was Liz Rose. And Liz, I wrote with her and Martin Armour a lot, and they started to have a lot of success. And I remember thinking, okay, well, it's all around me. If they're having success, eventually I'm going to have success. You know, I'm seeing this happen for these people that I get the opportunity to work with. So yeah, that was definitely a signpost. Just people in town knowing my songs, approaching me about different songs. Mm-hmm. That was a signpost, you know, like going into a publishing company and having a publisher I didn't work with say, oh my God, I heard that song you wrote, Hold My Hand. Those were all like pats on the back and okay, I'm doing the right thing. Now, there were times, I will say, during that 15 years where I would get discouraged and would think, am I doing the right thing? I would always say, should I sell real estate? I don't know why I think I would be good at selling real estate, but that was what I would always say, like, maybe I should sell real estate. I don't know that I'd be great at that, so I don't know why I would go to that, but probably because I saw signs in yards, I don't know, but anybody who listens to this who's an artist or a writer, I did have a lot of self-doubt, and I think most songwriters and artists do.
How has that evolved? Because that's another one of the things that I love to hear about is, has success changed that for you? Do you still grapple with times where you question or worry, like, is this going to continue? Or what has outside affirmation done to your internal sense?
I think sometimes success makes that worse. I really do, because, you know, some people outside affirmation has told you, wow, what you did, we really thought was great. So then you're sitting there thinking, oh God, that's the best I can do. What's next? And I know for me, I always have a lot of doubt right before I'm starting a new project, which is right now. I've been writing, but really starting to dive into writing for a new record. And that's always, you know, I was talking to Jesse Jo Dillon, who we write a lot of songs, and telling her that. And she said, well, you know, B, I'm going to remind you, you always feel like this at this stage. So I think the reason why it feels like success makes it almost worse is that we all think, once I am successful or once I reach this certain spot, I won't feel this way. And then you do and you still do. So it feels worse. I saw an interview on 60 Minutes with the guys in Red Hot Chili Peppers. And they asked one of them, he said something about how he was really highly insecure. And whoever was interviewing said, are all artists that way? And he said, well, all the good ones are.
Mm.
And I think that's true, because anybody that I work with who struggles with that is typically a little bit better because they're digging a little deeper and harder. Now, I think we all have confidence in different areas. You know, I know artists who are supremely confident on stage, but not so much in a writing room. So I think it spreads out. I hope nobody's completely insecure or completely confident. I don't think it makes it better. I think it probably just is about the same, but it feels worse because you've had success, so you think it should go.
Yeah, absolutely. In my experience and in talking with friends, that self-doubt voice can become deafening. Are there things that you've found that help you bypass that, at least quiet it enough that you can take action and get back to work?
I think just working. You know, I think if you just dive in and you continue to do the work, it goes away because your mind's thinking about creating whatever it is instead of, I'm not sure if I can do this.
Well, and I think that's also where it comes in, balancing like the creative work with the business outcomes. If you've gotten success from a song you wrote and then you're trying to recreate that, maybe artistically and creatively, you do feel like you're able to craft a song just as well. But there's all these other factors that maybe it doesn't perform the same way. And even like we had Gretchen Peters on here and she talked about when she wrote Independence Day, how publishers and people were like, okay, do that again a million times over. And Gretchen talked about how she was like, I knew emotionally I couldn't. That was a once in a lifetime song that I was lucky that I was able to craft. And like, it's two different compartments, if that makes sense, the way that I'm thinking about it in my head. I think you're buddies with Mary Chapin Carpenter, and she was on here, and it's a quote I go back to all the time of, we were just like, your multi-platinum selling records and 18 Grammy nominations didn't cure you of self-doubt. And she was just like, no, no way.
Yeah, yeah. You just mentioned two massive influences for me, and Gretchen Peters and Mary Chapin. And I think what Gretchen said is so true, you know, about Independence Day being a once in a lifetime song. And she was smart enough to see that and not try to replicate it, because then you just get paler versions of it. Mm-hmm. And I've done that. Now, I haven't released those songs, but I have definitely done that, because you do think that worked and that moved people. So I'm going to try to do something like that again, but it never does it because it's not inspired. Those really great pieces of art, whether it's a painting or music, it's really inspired. And the other days you're just practicing for when you get that inspired moment, but you can't copy inspiration. You can make copies of it like a record or photocopy a painting. I mean, you can do it again, but with a different idea. A different moment of inspiration. Somebody said to me early on in my record making career, they challenged me to never make the same record twice. Maybe you should always work with a different producer and that kind of talk. And I really worked hard to not do that, for every record to be different. And it's hard, because I really think as beings, we have a song or two in us that's really ours. And then the rest of it is with collaboration and outside influences, but you have to be really cognizant of it. And there are artists that I see who I feel like are always striving to make great music and do something different. Like Keith Urban is a good example. He's always taking chances. I saw an interview with him recently where he said that he had made a record and he just scrapped it because he started to play it for people and they were just lukewarm on it. Mm. And I thought, man, that is really inspiring to me because he's at a level where he could do whatever he wants and be on autopilot, but he chooses not to. I think it's because he's a true artist. And I strive for that myself. Gretchen Peters, a great example, strives for that. Mary Chapin definitely strives for that. Dwight Yoakam, somebody I've worked with, you know, I remember he told me one time, I asked him what his favorite album was that he had recorded, and he said, it's always the last one. Man, that's a great way to be. It's such an amazing way to feel about your art. And you can only feel like that, I think, if you're really truly inspired and you're, what you're putting out is a representation of where you are right now.
Yeah. And again, really being centered in the work of the art rather than the result. Some of us think it's fun and some of us hate it, of like the promotion and performing and award shows and all those things. But like, if that is like attached to the feeling around an album or the songs you're making, I think trying to like separate them is part of the goal and why it makes each new and current project more interesting and fun for an artist if they're really present in the actual work and not the outside career stuff.
That gets harder also. I think the album that you're the most present for is your first, because mm-hmm. you'd never done it before. And I always try to figure out how to get back to that first time feeling. This last album was the closest I'd come to that. And it was because the making of it was so different and did take me back to when I first started out. But I do think if you can separate yourself from accolades or from the outcome of your music, all you can control is what you create. You can't control how it's received, the way it's marketed. You know, you just can't control that stuff. And that's hard because you do get tied up in it. But that's how I always know, too, that something is great, at least great for me, is if when I'm creating it, I'm not thinking about those things. I'm just thinking about getting the emotion of it out.
Yeah. I'm interested because I used to spend years on the road and now I produce records and we're here in my studio. And so I'm a big fan and have a lot of interest in creating situations and environments that then create the headspace or the inspiration to make something special. So I'm wondering, with this recent record where you said you were the closest to that first time feeling, did you approach it in a new way intentionally to kind of have that on edge new feeling, or was that just happenstance?
I guess I did approach it that way in that I chose to work with Brandi Carlile mm-hmm. on it. She had approached me about making a record and she said, I see it as your return to the Northwest. And that really pulled me in because that's where I started. That's where I grew up. And I didn't know what her process would be like, but it was very different from producers I had worked with in the past. It was all live, trying to get everybody to get the best take they could together. Not a lot of overdubs. So that was different. And I really enjoyed it. And it kept everybody, myself mostly, on our toes. And it was really more about feel than about anything technical. And that's always good to be reminded of. I mean, she said something to me in the process of picking the songs that took me back to the beginning. And that I asked her, I always give a producer a handful of songs, usually like 18 to 24 songs that have been whittled down from what I've been writing and also from my catalog. And then I let them choose the last 10 or 12. And there's always a few in there that I'm going to fight for if they don't choose them. But by that point, I'm pretty happy with the list. And I loved her choices and I was surprised by some of them. And I asked her, you know, why she chose what she chose. And she said, they were all great songs, but I chose the ones when I listened to them, I felt like you had written them in your bedroom and not a writing room. That was a good reminder to me because it's easy when you're in a place like Nashville where I think the greatest songwriters in the world are here. You want to impress each other. And so oftentimes you write songs to impress your peers versus just trying to get that emotion out that needs to have melody and chords next to it. That took me back to the beginning of why I started to write songs. So it was all sort of a journey back. And there wasn't a lot of overthinking in the process of recording this record. That was different for me. It was just really live and raw.
Did you guys record in Washington? Or?
Well, we were going to, and then she was having some remodeling done at her studio, and it was taking longer. So we ended up recording actually in Malibu, California at Rick Rubin's Shangri-La studio. Mm-hmm. And okay. That was a different vibe. That was a really Looking back, it was way cooler than I even knew it was while we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh yeah, that was such a great vibe.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
I'm always curious, though, about how, like, location and place informs songs and recording process. And so I'm curious more about her saying, this is your back to the Northwest, because I also grew up mostly in Washington State, and it has, like, the dampness of it and the beauty of the mountains. It has such a feeling that feels so different than Nashville, obviously, and California. So,
yeah, I mean, I had never, when she said that, I had never leaned into that. I mean, I had had times of where I'd written songs about small towns, you know, because I come from Morton, Washington, really small town. But it really inspired me to write a song like Northwest. She Smoked in the House about my grandma. That was all written after Brandy and I had that initial conversation. And I think just saying that, like, it's your return mm-hmm. to the Northwest, really just pulled me in and mm-hmm. did make me write songs a little differently.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself doing that for records, where once you get a clearer picture of what this record could potentially be, do you find yourself writing to fill out that image? Or is it mostly more often that you have songs that would be ready for a record and you choose from there?
What usually happens is I'll write a song that feels like it could be the centerpiece of an album that might be like, oh, wow, we could build around that. Last time it was actually a song on there called Up Above the Clouds. We wrote that song on a retreat. I was so moved by it. I thought, oh, I've got something that is worth recording. Now, that song ended up, I wouldn't call it the centerpiece of that record once the record was done, but it's a start. And you're mm-hmm. like, okay. The time before it was I'll Be the Sad Song, and that ended up starting the record. And the record was called Your Life is a Record. And then the time before that, it was Big Day in a Small Town. When we wrote mm-hmm. that song, I knew, like, oh, this could be a record. And that song, I think, was written quite a ways before I started that record. But to answer your question, I'll get that one song and then start filling it in. A lot of times it's songs that are already written. Like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, well, I've always loved that song, but it never made sense for me. Now it does. And then once I get a vibe, like I mentioned Northwest, oh, I want a song. Maybe there's a song called Northwest. So it's a both and an and. But I always love that feeling when I'm like, ooh, this could be the centerpiece.
Yeah, I like that idea. It's kind of, a song is a thesis statement, or it has this kind of gravitational pull mm-hmm. to it that you follow. Absolutely.
Are you writing all the time, especially as your life has gotten busier with performing and touring? What's your relationship to making time to write? Is it something that you have to be intentional about? Is it always flowing? Do you have, like, personal life practices that help you stay connected to that?
I definitely have to be more intentional with it than I once did. I was a 5-day a week songwriter. I'm not that anymore because of all the things you just said. So I have to be more intentional with it. I think there's a good and a bad to that. I'm about to be very intentional with it for about the next 6 months. That's all I'm going to be doing. So the closer I am to that, the happier I am when I'm creating. But I also find I used to feel like I had to write every day. I don't feel so much that way anymore because when I don't, my songs tend to be better. Example, like last week, I wrote a song for a project, for a documentary. And I had been thinking about that song for a long time. I was like, what's that going to be? And so, you know, I watched the bit of the documentary that the people making it had sent me. I sent it to a co-writer who I thought would be right for it. And we got together and we really knocked it out of the park. And I think, okay, it's because I really took a lot of time, as did he, to prepare for the 3 or 4 hours that we were in the room writing a song. And when you're writing every day, several hours a day, I don't think you can do that mm-hmm. as easily. You tend to tread over the same ground. There's also a positive in that. You're keeping your tools sharp. When you're not writing every day, your tools maybe aren't as sharp. But when you do sit down to write, I think you are more intentional. And for me, if I know I have less time, I waste less time. When I was a 5-day a week songwriter, if I'm being really honest, a couple of those days a week were usually wasted talking. songwriters get a room and you just talk for hours and you're like, oh, let's rebook. We'll do it again. And I think all of that is beneficial. I'm just at a spot in my life where I don't have time to do that. I might have 2 or 3 days a week to write versus 4 or 5. So I can't spend those days talking. Also, you know, in COVID, when we started to Zoom write, I really learned, oh, wow, when you Zoom, you just get right to it. That was positive, too. I still do Zoom writes with people that I'm not in the same city as. But you have to be more intentional. I find when I'm getting into a season of writing, the more I read, the better my writing is. And just fill my well with other things, be it TV shows or podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
I need to stay in language, I guess, is the thing there.
I like hearing you say season of writing. Like, especially moving to Nashville, I wasn't going to pursue being a songwriter like on Music Row, but we lived in New York City for a long time before we moved here. And then I would dip my toe in it and be like, is this something I could do? And I would always get the information about, well, you have to be writing every day. And I thought something was really wrong with me for a long time that I was like, I don't think I can do that. I don't think it's in my nature. And the older I've gotten, the more I've come to understand, like, okay, if your goal is to write to the market and you need a lot of songs to be pitching, like, absolutely. But if you have different goals, it's okay to kind of follow your natural rhythm as a writer. And I've found I'm much more of a seasonal writer, gathering information, like you said, bringing stuff in and then, okay, next 6 months, I'm going to focus on writing. And now I'm able to excavate in a way. And it releases this pressure and guilt for the time when you're not writing that I think makes it all more enjoyable and more accessible.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're all different. And I don't know, even people I know, and I've been in that groove where you're writing every day, you still have seasons in that. Like when you look back on your songs, for me, I'll be like, oh, wow, isn't that crazy? The month of August that year, I wrote 3 really great songs. And I'll look back and, well, there in June and July, I was building towards that. I was writing songs that were almost hitting the mark, but weren't quite. I do think somebody can write 5 days a week, 2 appointments a day. They still are going to hit seasons that are more fruitful.
Yeah, not to get like super insider baseball here, but I'm interested in what percentage of songs that you start that you finish, and then past that, what percentage of those actually see the light of day, whether it's on your record or on somebody else's record?
I finish most things I start. And some things I start by myself and I can't crack them. And so I'll take the idea into a co-write. I would say the percentage that sees the light of day, either with me or anybody else, is probably that 10%.
Mm-hmm. That's also nice to hear.
Yeah.
Michaela and I have been making this show for quite a while now, talking to some of our favorite artists about how they protect their sanity and stay inspired. We don't typically talk directly about our own work outside of the podcast here, but we wanted to open that door.
In addition to hosting this podcast, as well as touring and writing and recording my own music, I work one-on-one as a songwriting coach, helping people explore and expand their own creativity. If you're feeling blocked, navigating self-doubt, or just wanting to excavate deeper, more specific stories in your writing, I help you build a grounded practice you trust and get words back on the page.
And at the other end of the creative process in the studio, I work as a producer and a mix engineer. I love to partner with artists to take those songs and craft intentional, memorable records that last and create an environment that is open, where we can explore, and where creativity always comes first.
So if you're looking for guidance with your writing or you're ready to make your next record, we love connecting with people who care deeply about this work.
You can learn more about working with either of us at theother22hours.com/hosts. That's theother22hours.com/hosts, or you can find links in the show notes.
I know you said keep language accessible and like really reading and all that stuff. Is there anything else that you feel like you've found is essential to like staying grounded in yourself, especially when your schedule's super busy on the road versus at home, like how you keep sane or grounded in yourself?
Working out really helps me. Staying off social media. When I'm in a period of time where I really want to be creative, I'll take the social media apps off my phone. If I'm going to go down a rabbit hole, it needs to be in a book or in a movie or something, not on social media. Something where I might get something from it. So those are pretty big. Working out, staying off social media, doing other creative things. You know, I recently, this is such a weird thing, but I've recently gotten into making these old school friendship bracelets with like embroidery thread. Ooh. And making my mind figure out those patterns is big. And a lot of times something like that, when I'm stuck, it'll get me unstuck because I'm focusing on something other than finishing that song.
I love that. Social media, do you feel like it's like a time sucker, but also does it impact your mindset or mental state?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it's mostly a big time suck. But if I go to the right or the wrong places, it can be mentally really debilitating. You know, somebody said a long time ago, like with social media, you're comparing your practice footage to somebody else's highlight reel. I just don't think that's good for any of us. It's for an addictive brain, and we all, I think, have those. And so just scrolling and scrolling just does me no good.
Yeah.
One thing that I've been focusing on lately, because there's been periods in my life where I've been off of social media for a year and a half at a time, just to really just get away and clear that. The thing that's been resonating with me lately, and I've been grateful that I haven't really been in the kind of mental spiral rabbit hole of social media. I also don't post a lot, but I notice that throughout the day, throughout the week, there's this voice in the back of my head, oh, you need to make a post, or you need to do this, or, you know, you need to stay top of mind and all of that. And it's like, I'm not physically interacting with social media, but it's still occupying part of my brain. If I cut that avenue off, that's not there. It's just not an option. And it can be a little bit more present.
Yeah, it by nature like makes us center ourselves a lot. Not center ourselves in a positive way. Center ourselves in the story of I need to be remembered, so I need to be posting. It makes me think about myself too much.
Yeah, it's a really narcissistic, a really wise person told me that the only other place where we talk about followers are cult leaders.
Yes.
So basically it's turning everyone into a cult leader. I mean, it's not healthy, and I'm on it. I sound like a hypocrite, but it's breeding just narcissism.
Yeah, or doom. Last night, we have a three-year-old, and I was so tired last night, I put her to bed, and then I'm like, oh, I should read a book. And all of a sudden, an hour goes by, and I'm still on my phone, and I start feeling physically so anxious because I was just consuming election stuff. And I'm like, what is this actually doing? I'm not more informed in a way that's helping me or engaged. Yeah. This morning I was telling Aaron about it, and Aaron was like, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to sign up for phone banking this week? How are we going to turn this into something?
That's a good place to put that.
Yeah. And so you're heading into making a new record right now, you said?
Writing it. Once I get the songs and feel really good about that, then I'll head into the making of it. I mean, my A&R guy says, I think you're closer than you think. I don't think I'm that close. But I think after 6 months, I might be. So that's exciting to me.
For 6 months, you're not going to play shows or anything? And it's going to be just writing?
I mean, I have a few. Like, I'm playing Girls Just Wander in Mexico. And I'm doing an ACL taping with the Indigo Girls. But other than that, no, I'll just be writing.
Is that a normal practice for you? Do you kind of have set time and create your own big tent writing camp thing?
Yeah, it's just been a while since I haven't been on the road. So it's really nice to think about like, okay, for the next 6 months, I can just write songs and just get in the studio and see what works and explore. And another thing I love to do that inspires me sometimes is to get a new instrument that has maybe some different sounds. Like I'm toying around with maybe doing more 12-string stuff, and that would inspire this different sound, and that inspires different songs. I believe that guitars have songs in them, those sorts of things. I love diving into all that.
Yeah.
How has it been? Because I know you wrote Shucked with your longtime collaborator, Shane McAnally. How is that like writing for a show rather than even writing for, you know, trying to pitch to other artists or your own project, writing in this musical endeavor?
It was really great. And I would suggest it to any songwriters who want to do something a little different. The biggest challenge is, you know, you're telling a story over 2.5 hours versus 2.5 to 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so you have to tell little bits of the story with longer, like you have to spend a longer time maybe on a certain emotion. Our opening number is 7 minutes long, and it's a celebration of corn. So we have to find all these ways to talk about corn. And so that's a massive challenge and a really fun one. The part that's easier is nothing's off limits. You're telling this story, and so you just tell it however the best way is to tell it. You don't have to worry about, oh, is that going to get played? You're just telling your story.
Cool.
Yeah, I can imagine. Did that ripple into your artist writing when you're getting back to writing 3.5 minute songs?
the biggest thing it's done for me artistically is it's given me the confidence that I can write records, because with a musical, you're sitting down and you're like, okay, we need however many songs to tell this story. Eight, let's say 18. And we did it. It took us 10 years. It takes most people 5 to 20 years to write a musical. So I know I can do a big project. That's one thing it really gave me. And it probably makes me a little more fearless in the kinds of songs I'll write on my own records, because I really see, oh, people want the truth. So let's write that versus overthinking too much of what people want to hear.
Yeah, I'm super curious how that, especially being a Music Row mainstream Nashville songwriter and then writing your own artist story, has that been something you've had to like continuously overcome, or did you have any fear, especially being an openly gay woman? And I'm not inside the pop country music world, so I'm always curious kind of the outside image is that it is very conservative. Has that been on your mind or contributed to any apprehension or nervousness? And have you increasingly been emboldened as you've built your confidence over time?
First, I just thought there was no way that I could be an artist and be openly gay, and I wasn't going to go back into the closet. I mean, just can't. At first, yes, I thought it was either or. I was lucky enough that there were people who just believed great music should win, and those people helped me make my first record and have continued to help me make records. I got really lucky that way, and it's not even anything I think about anymore, but there was a time where it kept me up at night. Not so much once I made a record, but before that, because I just thought that's not an option for me. And I'm so glad that I did make a record, because not only did it change my life, but I think it changed lives of people coming in the future who are listening to my music. Because I know for me, I remember Katie Lang. I'm thinking, man, she's fantastic. And oh, she's also gay. And so I think there are a lot more of those examples now than there were then. The world has changed, and thank God, because I think about the thoughts I had of how that would keep me from a career. I hope somebody who's 21 and gay and moving to Nashville today doesn't have the same inner turmoil that I did. If me being in the world making music can help that, then I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah, it's, I don't even want to say easy to forget, because it depends on what kind of like bubble you're living in. But, you know, Shelley Wright's story. I've gotten to know Shelley over the years, and I grew up watching her on CMT and like thinking she was incredible. And then as an adult now, learning more about her experience of coming out and how groundbreaking that was. But then even in recent years, like the backlash for the song Girl Crush, it's still so unfortunate that it's still out there. And so, like you said, having people who are just openly themselves and making music, I feel like it's very cliched, but representation really matters. It's really important to have all these examples of there's a million ways to be in this world and this life and be artists and experience success. And songwriters and storytellers are the way that we get to experience that and learn about each other. That I think is why we do what we do and what's so beautiful about this work.
There's a guy who just put a record out last Friday. I haven't heard all of it, but what I've heard of it, it's amazing, fancy, hey, good.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think about the kind of music he's making. It's going to actually save a lot of lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Just being able to embody and demonstrate that, like, I mean this with the most love and the most sensitivity, but like my story is valid. Again, I'm a cisgendered white male. I understand historically where, you know, I am in history, but the attention and the care and the openness that is being shown to the LGBTQ community, it inherently has that title with it. And so it inherently has that next to, oh, it's an LGBTQ story. It's an LGBTQ path. But like removing that to me shows a quality.
It's just a human story.
It's just a story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful story. It's a moving story. And I see what you have done and what Fancy is doing. All of these people coming out, bringing that to the front, and just the general public just being able to embrace these stories and relate to these stories is just like a beautiful thing for me to be able to observe and you know, just to share some gratitude with you. I've made two records myself in here this year with artists where you and your story and your output has been a reference for the records. So I can say firsthand that you are definitely making an impact on
young artists feeling more confident to share their own stories.
Sure.
That fills my heart up. So thank you for telling me that.
Well, that feels like a beautiful way to bring this to a close. we've done like 80 some episodes and I've never asked this of anyone, but I'm just super curious if there was something that you wish you had known as a younger artist at this point.
One thing that somebody shared with me that I wish I would have gotten to sooner is don't stay in any room where you don't feel like a genius. Because a lot of times you get put in rooms, be it as a writer or an artist, where you don't feel real seen or like the other people in the room don't love what you do. I saw this thing on social media, actually, and it was talking about a bottle of water and how a bottle of water at the grocery store is $1. And at the airport, it's $6. And it said, maybe it's not that you're not worth so much. Maybe you're sitting in the wrong spot. And I think that's really true. If you believe in yourself artistically and other people aren't validating that for you, maybe you need to move. How do we move towns? I mean, that you might need to do that, but maybe get into a different circle. Definitely, if you're co-writing, don't try to make that work. Find the people that make you feel like a genius. That's really the trick, because you got to feel at your best to create your best work is what I really feel and what I've experienced in my own life.
I love that.
Beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, guys.
This morning to sit down with us.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.